Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's address today to the annual AIPAC conference, where the members of the Israeli lobby were told the President has Israel's back and he won't hesitate to use force, although Obama warned there's been too much loose talk about a war with Iran. Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University, Stephen Walt, joins us. He's the co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Then we will speak with the Russian journalist Masha Gessen about today's election in Moscow of Vladimir Putin, which comes as no surprise. But what is surprising is how long it has taken the West to wake up to who this small-minded KGB thug is, and how in such a short time he has destroyed years of progress and has made Russia a threat to her own people and the world. Masha Gessen is the author of the new book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Then finally, we'll speak with one of the founding members of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street of former finance professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens who are lobbying the SEC for stronger regulations and oversight of federally backstopped banks and the prohibition of risky activities within them. Caitlin Klein, a former credit derivatives trader, joins us. Joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He is the author of The Origins of Alliances, which received the 1988 Edgar S. Furness National Security Book Award, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He has an op-ed on AIPAC in tomorrow's Financial Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And the President made this sort of mixed signals there today at AIPAC, where he did the sort of ritual solidarity with Israel speech, but also said there's been too much loose talk about war with Iran. But I think what was notable, though, was that he was preceded by Liz Cheney, who ripped into the administration for abandoning Israel, and former Congresswoman Jane Harman, who criticized the Obama administration for using Israel as a political football. So do you think that the President's remarks, even though they were met with a respectfully by AIPAC, they weren't met with a lot of enthusiasm?
I think that's fair to say. A polite reception, but not certainly rapturous enthusiasm. And one thing to remember is that AIPAC is a fairly hardline group. It's not representative of the views of the entire American Jewish community, probably not even doesn't even represent median opinion within the American Jewish community. So the fact that the Obama administration or the fact that the President didn't get a warm welcome reflects the fact that a lot of the people in that room weren't going to vote for him in the first place, and you know, not surprisingly, didn't hear quite as much red meat support as they might have liked.
So there's obviously been a lot of positioning and posturing prior to this meeting, and there's an expectation that Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, who is in town and meeting with the President on Monday, is using AIPAC as a way to put pressure on the President. There's been all sorts of rumors of war, and the dogs of war have not been slipped loose yet. But there are a couple of scenarios. One is that Netanyahu could attack Iran during the election, drive up the price of oil, and leave Obama twisting in the wind. He's not given any assurances he won't do that. And on the other hand, it seems that the U.S. is offering assurances to Israel that if they sort of restrain themselves until after the elections, if the sanctions don't work, then Obama's prepared to use force. And of course, the U.S. actually has the force that would be applicable as opposed to Israel.
Yeah, there is a fundamental strategic gap now between the Israeli government and the U.S. government. And it's not just, you know, President Obama. It's also the American military leadership. I think that America's diplomatic corps, America's intelligence services, in this sense, it's not obviously just the president's decision. The U.S. government and the Israeli government see this one differently. They agree that Iran with nuclear weapons would not be a good thing, but they completely disagree about the situation that we're facing now and what the best course of action for dealing with it is. Prime Minister Netanyahu, to judge by his statements and other statements coming out of Israel, would like the United States to deal with Iran's nuclear facilities. And if the United States is not willing to do that militarily, then he would at least like a green light from the United States to do it himself, and perhaps a guarantee that we will come to their aid if Iran retaliates. The Obama administration, and especially the U.S. military leadership, see this one differently. They do not believe Iran has made a decision to seek nuclear weapons as opposed to a nuclear power and nuclear enrichment capability. And in fact, they worry that attacking Iran is one of the ways you would convince Iran's leaders that they had no choice but to go ahead and try and acquire a nuclear capability of their own as a deterrent. I think the American leadership also is worried about the geopolitical consequences of an attack, retaliation against Israel, retaliation against other American allies in the region, which Iran could do, perhaps not in devastating fashion, but in ways that would be uncomfortable, not to mention the impact of higher oil prices on a still fragile world economic recovery. Finally, the administration, and I think the U.S. government, believes that diplomacy has a chance of working here, that Iran is under tremendous pressure, and that we may eventually get a diplomatic deal that avoids the need for using force. So they don't want Israel to do anything, and they're not promising to do anything right now. What the president said in his speech was that he is prepared to take action if that's necessary to prevent a nuclear weapons capability, but we are some considerable distance from Iran having that capability, and they may not even be trying to get there.
You mentioned a bit ago, Dr. Stephen Walt, that that AIPAC is a hardline right-wing group that don't reflect the diversity of Jewish opinion in this country. And it would seem that in many ways, neither does Netanyahu in Israel, even though Israel has, as President Clinton has mentioned, has sort of moved inexorably to the right, largely through the emigration from Russia. Nevertheless, in a recent poll by Haaretz, the one in five Israelis support Netanyahu's unilateral action against Iran without American support. Israelis understand the importance of the alliance that they have with the United States, more so than apparently AIPAC does and Netanyahu does.
Well, I think in the case, certainly Israelis are more worried about what Iran may be doing than the United States does, just given proximity. But I think many Israelis do understand that, first of all, war has real risks for Israel, particularly if it further alienates the United States and Israel. But also, the Israeli defense forces do not have the capability to take out all of Iran's nuclear facilities. And it's important to note that in a sense, neither does the United States. The United States could do more damage if we were to go to war, but we can't stop Iran from pursuing a nuclear capability. We cannot destroy the knowledge that they have acquired for how to do this. So even if the United States or Israel were to attack and set back their program for some period of time, they could always reconstitute it. They can disperse it in more places, make it even less vulnerable in the future. So at best, war would only delay it. It would just make Iran hopping mad and also probably more resolved that maybe they would need actual weapons as opposed to just an enrichment capability. And I think some of that reality is reflected in the polls you were talking about.
But one of the realities that's not reflected, I think, is the intense partisanship in terms of foreign policy, which, you know, traditionally there's been always been this, I think, an illusion that we have a bipartisan foreign policy. Now, some of the people at AIPAC said that this is one of the, Lindsey Graham among them, said this is one of the few areas where we have bipartisanship on a need to do something about Iran. But the truth of the matter is that Netanyahu is much closer to the Republicans than he is to Obama, and he's shown some contempt towards Obama, as is the Republicans show contempt on a regular basis. Lindsey Graham and John McCain were recently in Israel undercutting the president. They pushed through the National Defense Authorization Act that put pressure on the president, and he threatened to veto it because it would effectively cause a rise in the price of gas, which is clearly a problem for Obama in an election year. How much do you think that partisan politics are going to play a role in this? And is there a possibility of a very cynical notion that the Republicans and Netanyahu together could do the only thing that could possibly derail President Obama's re-election.
Well, I don't think President Obama's re-election is a sure thing, regardless of what they do. But I think there's no question that partisan motives are deeply involved here. And the problem that the Republicans are facing now is that, in fact, they don't have very much to criticize President Obama on with respect to foreign policy. He got us out of a very unpopular war in Iraq. I believe he is trying to get us out of an unpopular commitment in Afghanistan. But at the same time, he got Osama bin Laden. He has been more successful and more assertive at waging war against al-Qaeda than President Bush was. The American economy has started to turn around. America's image around the world is much better than it was in 2008. And in fact, Obama has done a much better job of rounding up international pressure in the form of economic sanctions against Iran than President Bush ever did. So it's simply not, you know, there's not a lot of issues that you can try and point to on the foreign policy front if you're trying to attack the president. He's been, in some respects, as hardline as President Bush was, just a lot more effective at it. And therefore, they are, I think, somewhat desperately trying to make an issue out of Israel. Now, I would make one final point. I think President Obama has actually been a much better friend to Israel than President Bush ever was. And in a sense, the big difference between Netanyahu and Obama is where they think the existential threat to Israel really is. For Netanyahu, he keeps talking about Iran, but I think President Obama believes the real existential threat to Israel is the failure to resolve the Palestinian issue and the continued occupation, which threatens Israel's long-term legitimacy, threatens Israel's long-term political future in ways that Iran doesn't. And that's the real disagreement, although you're not hearing very much about that right now because the president doesn't really want to bring that issue to the fore in an election year.
And that's the last thing that that Netanyahu wants to talk about, because he doesn't have a policy. I mean,
He does have a policy. His policy is to treat the Palestinian issue as an issue simply to be managed until permanent Israeli control of the West Bank is an accomplished fact. I believe that's his objective. And therefore, you don't want a peace process that's going anywhere, or if you have one, you want it to be dragged out forever. This, I believe, is a very short-sighted policy that actually does threaten Israel's future much more than Iran ever could.
But just in closing, though, Stephen Walt, my suggestion is that if something were to happen, you know how the press is, that they'll just go hysterical about a war, and they'll even write theme songs as they did with the Iraq War, and the president would be in an incredibly difficult position. As much as Americans are weary of war, you know, when it becomes a big news story in the first few weeks, people lose their minds.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there is going to be an American war anytime soon, and certainly not between now and November. And I think I'd be inclined to say that the Israelis are not going to start a war in that period as well. And one difference between now and 2002 is in the 2002, 2003, in the run-up to the Iraq War, the administration then, the Bush administration, was actively seeking a war. They had decided they wanted to go to war against Iraq, and they were doing everything they could to push media and others to support that, and many parts of the media did. I think that's rather different now. I believe the Obama administration understands a war with Iran is not smart, not good for us, and not good for Israel or any of our other friends in the region, and therefore they're not going to be fueling those flames. And so far, I think media coverage has been much more straightforward, much more honest. They've obviously talked about the various people pushing for the war, but they've also provided the counter-arguments as well. So I'm hopeful, although not 100% sure, that we're not going to do something foolish this time around.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice talking with you.
Again, Dr. Stephen Walt's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and he has an op-ed on the APEC conference in tomorrow's Financial Times. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the small-minded KGB thug who rules Russia.
And it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that. When people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends. hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns, talking like they're going to war. 'Cause they found something.
And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done. Already know how this will end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marcia Gessen, who is a journalist and author of several books. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications. She is the editor of a popular science magazine and lives in Moscow and is the author of the new book, Just Out, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcia Gessen.
Thank you.
And already it's no surprise that Putin will be elected as president. Apparently, there are many reports of carousel voting in which busloads of voters are driven around to cast ballots multiple times. And apparently, they've given them little armbands or ribbons or ways to identify them. And then the election officials at the various polling stations hand them ballots of people who are not likely to vote. So that's just one of the many tricks underway. I guess none of this surprises you, right?
I'm a little surprised at the scale and the obviousness of the falsifications. We knew there would be vote rigging, but we actually expected that most of it would be sort of technical, that it would be happening behind the scenes at the level when the ballots go from the local election precincts to the Territorial Election Commission, which tallies up those numbers. I actually thought that most of it would happen there, sort of behind the scenes. It's incredible. I mean, it looks like an actual agony of the regime, the way that they're being completely blatant about it, and also what's happening in the streets of Moscow today. The streets are lined with Interior Ministry troops. Hundreds of thousands of youth seem to have been bussed in for a celebration in the streets of Moscow today.
That's the Nashi group.
Well, it's the Nashi and the Nashi likes. I mean, we obviously can't identify every single person who's been bussed in as Nashi, mm-hmm. but they seem to be youths from the provinces.
So when you say it's brazen, I mean, isn't that the whole point of Putin? And which is why your book is so welcome, because for the longest time over the years, I've been talking to Russians about the death of their newborn democracy. And it's been pretty clear that Russia has become KGB incorporated and that Putin is a thug. And yet Western experts continue to make apologies for him, but yet he is so brazen. So that's the disconnect. His brazen actions, which are in your face and meant to signal to the Russian people that I'm the boss, and this pathetic kind of chorus of Western apologists.
You're quite right, and the Western media gave him a free ride for years and years. Actually, when the basic structures of the Putin regime were being put in place, his first 4-year term, when he eliminated most elections, when he dismantled all political institutions, when he made the judiciary, when the executive branch swallowed up the judiciary, and when he killed independent media. While all of that was going on, the American press was writing about Putin as a democratic and as an economic reformer.
So was it George W. Bush looking into his eyes and seeing his soul? Did that send this incredibly negative signal that we're talking about?
Well, I'd hate to think that the American media only listened to the president in their coverage. I think that there's actually a series of unfortunate accidents and some institutional problems with the coverage. I mean, the unfortunate coincidence was that while a lot of the early Putin stuff was going on, the American media were writing about the hung Bush-Gore election and had absolutely no interest in what was going on outside the country. Then 9/11 happened. Then Afghanistan happened. And basically all foreign coverage in the United States for a couple of years after 9/11 was focused on Afghanistan and then on Iraq. And Russia was just able to do its thing behind the scenes. For a long time, Moscow, which used to be a very important foreign posting for American media, became a way station for reporters working in Kabul.
And Masha, your new book just out, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, it's extraordinary that this very small-minded, petty, vain little man has been so powerful and so pervasive and has had such an effect on history and has been able to stifle Russian democracy in the cradle and albeit without much of a peep from the West. In terms of his vanity, though, it seems to me that may be his Achilles heel. I understand from friends like Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of Khrushchev, and others have said that he had a plastic surgery recently, and which looks like they botched it, actually. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for the kind of Muscovites who are now protesting. Is that something that you can verify?
Well, I don't know that the Botox scandal was the straw that broke the camel's back. I think it was actually corruption and the basic humiliation and indignity of living in the Russian state. But he looks ridiculous. He looks like, I'm not sure it's botched plastic surgery. It looks like he couldn't stop, like a lot of victims of plastic surgery. So he just kept injecting himself with more and more Botox. It's humiliating to live in a country that's run by a president who looks ridiculous, in addition to all the other indignities. So I think in that sense, yeah, it's a contributing factor.
But that's not to make light of the brutality that he's meted out and the cynicism, the brazen nature of the blowing up the apartment buildings as a pretext to get into the Second Chechen War, the cursed the submarine, and then later the theater attack, which looks like a staged operation where he was totally in charge and didn't care about the lives of the Russian people in there, the innocent civilians, many of whom even brought up the Kursk in their last moments of life, didn't even bother to have the Narcan available, which is what they bring back heroin addicts with, because it's the gas that was being used was a state secret. Totally the mentality of a KGB apparatchik, and not a very distinguished one at that.
You're absolutely right. And I think that the brutality is sort of the extreme expression of what you feel when you live in Russia. You know, from the getting your passport extended or getting your driver's license to getting licenses for your business, you're always met with a complete disregard for human dignity and for human life. And the ultimate expression of it is obviously what has happened when it's come to violence. There's overwhelming evidence that the apartment bombings that cost more than 300 lives and that produced the first surge of popularity for Putin, who had been a virtual unknown until then, that those bombings were organized by the secret police. And that, of course, what makes the current situation, in addition to being very exciting because of the scale of the mass protest, also very scary because, as I said, we are seeing interior troops in the center of Moscow. The center of Moscow looks occupied from the pictures that people are posting on Facebook and things that people are saying to me on the phone. And there is, unfortunately, some chance of confrontation when people come out to protest tomorrow night. And I think there will be hundreds of thousands of protesters meeting with possibly hundreds of thousands of armed interior troops and also the tens or hundreds of thousands of provincial youths that have been bust in to show their support for Putin.
So is there a possibility that a man who is basically a thug and proud of it, I mean, some of the language he uses in press conferences, like rubbing out the Chechens in the outhouse, and in his biography, he went out of his way to talk about how he was a street tough and all that stuff. And he clearly is enamored with that kind of swaggering thuggery. But he's also insecure, and unfortunately the West has given him a free pass for too long, and now the Russian people are basically saying the emperor has no clothes, and in many ways humor and disdain is a powerful weapon, but he strikes back by blaming everything on the West. just as he's used provocations at home to build his career and to kill innocent Russians, is he likely to do something on the foreign stage if he becomes a pariah?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. I mean, it's possible, obviously, it can't be completely discounted, because his foreign policy stand, and really the only consistent foreign policy that he has pursued, is wanting to make Russia feared by the rest of the world. But I don't see that that he actually sees the rest of the world or the West as an enemy that he would like to confront with arms. In some ways, he's kind of too small for that, and he's most concerned about what's going on inside the country. But I really would not discount the probability of using some sort of provocation during the protests in Moscow.
So in terms of Navalny, one of the popular protesters who coined the phrase of United Russia being the party of thieves and swindlers, he's an ultra-nationalist, isn't he?
I wouldn't call him an ultra-nationalist.
Well, he's a nationalist, right?
He's a nationalist.
Right.
He's also a libertarian.
Uh-huh.
And more than anything else, he's a guy in his mid-30s who came of age around the time that that Putin had destroyed the media, the political institutions, and public discourse as a whole. And the problem is that's what you get when you have a vacuum of political culture. You get very primitive ideologies such as nationalism and libertarianism. I think it's too early to talk about emerging Russian politicians, because most likely we don't know the names of people who are going to enter politics once it's actually possible to enter politics. And even though I'm extremely uncomfortable with nationalism and somewhat uncomfortable with libertarianism, I wouldn't exaggerate those fears quite yet.
But in terms of the window that you write about in your new book, Masha Gessen, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, when you describe it in your last chapter of personally being involved in the massive demonstrations that took place after the fraudulent election, which in many ways actually reminded me of what happened in Iran, where, you know, the middle class knew that the government was corrupt and distant from them, but it was just too much of an insult to have an election so brazenly stolen, and people came out. And you described that scene, and it turns out your partner's father is an important person in terms of what, vote monitoring? Is that what he does?
Yes, he's the mastermind behind Russian election monitoring.
Right.
I'm very proud of that.
But the point that you make in the book is that the very television station, the first one that Putin took over, one of the first acts was to get rid of Gazinsky and confiscate his network. They were reported on it fairly. So is it possible that you're going to have a little more honesty in Russian journalism?
We're having a little bit more honesty all around. It's like what we're seeing is the bottom rung of the pyramid that Putin has constructed being slowly dismantled, sort of brick by brick. State television is beginning to sort of get out of control. You not only see some excellent coverage for which some people have gotten fired already, but you also see some irony on the part of the news anchors. You see them sort of signaling unambiguously to the audience that they're mouthing a line that they don't take seriously. You also see things like the editor-in-chief of the Yaroslavl State Television Station writing an open letter to his boss saying, "I'm taking sick leave until after the election because the election is making me sick." So that sort of thing is happening. We've also seen some heads of local election committees actually come out and talk about falsifications, honestly. And I think that once the dust settles down after this election, we'll also see that. Because what we're talking about right now is the unbelievable scale of violations. But I think we're also going to be talking about an increasing number of honest election officials on the local level.
So given the brazen activities of Putin and the connections to the murder of some prominent dissidents, I mean, obviously Anna Politkovskaya is one that we all know about. She was killed on Putin's birthday. But the poisoning of the Russian ex-KGB dissident in London with polonium, also Anna was poisoned with a poison that came out of the same KGB lab. And it also seems that even Putin's own mentor, again, which Western Russian experts always used to make the excuse of Putin, well, you know, he was a protege of the liberal Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. Well, it looks like Putin actually had him murdered as well by KGB poison.
This is true. Obviously, we don't have conclusive evidence on any of this, with the exception of the polonium poisoning of Litvinenko. The reason we don't have conclusive evidence is, of course, because the police and law enforcement in general are controlled by Putin, so none of the murders of the Putin era have been properly investigated, nor has Russia cooperated with the British investigation of the murder of Litvinenko. But there, the evidence is overwhelming simply because that kind of polonium is only produced by the Russian state and can only be released with the authorization at the highest level of government.
So what do you think is going to happen then in the next couple of years? And you're concerned about the next couple of days, Marcia, I guess, and given the presence of security police in Moscow, it seems like Putin is going to be kind of reviled and ridiculed in his own capital. But he still has a lot of support out there in the countryside. And I guess there are memories of some of the hardships that took place under Yeltsin. Do you think that since he's basically able to bribe the people into supporting him through oil money, at the moment that's it, the oil's up, but it may go down again. What's your prognosis on how this KGB incorporated form of kind of business thuggery that's going on in Russia, how much longer can it last? Is there just as you've mentioned in the media, there's a stirring of protest. Is it possible that within the entrepreneurial business class that Putin has largely stifled, is there likely to be a rebirth of energy there?
Yes. A couple of things. First of all, I think that the idea that Putin enjoys a lot of support outside of Moscow is not very accurate. There has been a lot of protest all over the country. There have been about 100 cities demonstrating simultaneously every time there have been large-scale protests in Moscow. The demographics of the protests are actually not, you know, overwhelmingly middle class at all. There are towns like the town of Kovrov, backwater of backwaters, population 145,000, with a protest of 120 people. Kovrov does not have a creative class, but Kovrov does have people who are fed up with living in the system, and that's really happening all over the country. Putin's short-sighted strategy of busing people in, forcing people to come out for protests in support of Putin is likely to backfire. There are now hundreds of thousands of people all over the country who have been forced to either spend their days off, standing in the freezing cold, demonstrating their supposed support for Putin, or who have otherwise been humiliated and had their will violated by being forced to engage in pro-Putin activity. So that's a ticking time bomb. And that points to a key difference of perception. Putin thinks that today is his victory day. It's the last day of the battle. He's going to declare victory in this election, whatever it costs him. Even though these brazen violations are apparently necessary for declaring this victory, and then he thinks it's over. But for the protest movement, it's really the beginning. I think that the kind of protest we're going to see tomorrow is going to be on an unprecedented scale. It's going to make the protests of the winter look small. So this is really the beginning of the battle, and I don't think that the Putin regime is capable of surviving it. The question is, will there be violence, and what kind of peaceful transition we can really hope for?
And you have to add a little insult to that injury when you mentioned, Marcia, about the people who've been bussed in and told to vote several times. They were supposed to be paid by Putin's operatives, and many of whom pocketed the money. So not only do they get used, they get ripped off, which is kind of a metaphor for Putin's Russia, right?
Absolutely. It's the system in miniature.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had more time. Perhaps we can revisit you because there's so much more to talk about.
That's great. Yes.
Again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a journalist and author of several books. She's contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter and Slate, among other publications. Marcia is the editor of a popular science magazine in Russia and lives in Moscow. Her new book just out is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a member of Occupy the SEC. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Caitlin Klein, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street composed of former finance professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of anti-lobby. OSEC recently submitted a 325-page comment letter to the SEC and other regulators on the so-called Volcker Rule, arguing for strong regulation and oversight of federally backstopped banks and the prohibition of risky activity within them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caitlin Klein.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And just a couple of days ago New York Times, there was an op-ed by Phil Angelides, the former head of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which Congress created to examine the full scope of the 2008 Wall Street financial meltdown. And he said, 4 years after the financial crisis, that nothing's happened, and all of the stuff that he looked into, even though they gave him no money to work with, and little subpoena power, the Justice Department haven't done anything with the information that he's provided them with. What's going on here? It seems like the guy that won the Academy Award for that wonderful documentary, Inside Job, at the Academy Awards last year, said nobody's gone to jail. So it's not like the public and the people out in America aren't saying what happened here and why no justice. So what's your answer to that question? Why no justice?
It's one of these things that it obviously takes a very, very long time to get anything substantial done in Washington. And, it's a problem certainly that we've seen for the past decade and coming through the financial crisis. And it feels right now as if they're at least starting to make use of some of the tools that they were given through the Dodd-Frank Act to sort of figure out what went wrong and try and make it right, which is, a few steps before going through and actually assigning blame. I would think that they would like to try and at least prohibit it from happening again right now. And, hopefully later on there's something that they can do to go and hold individuals accountable. But this is one thing that something we focused on that the Volcker Rule is really aiming to do. And it's trying to go in and say, what exactly were people doing at the time that really led to such a crisis? And what can we do to try and make sure that that doesn't happen again? And it really stems from the separation of commercial banks and investment banks that happened back with the Glass-Steagall Act. And, really for most of the century in the 1900s, it really made some very, responsible changes in the banking industry, not allowing investment banks and commercial banks to, merge and use your deposits to be able to go and basically gamble individuals' money. And that worked reasonably well for a long time. And as deregulation started to happen later on in the century, those two very separate functions really got pretty clouded and they merged together in a lot of ways. And what happened is people could start to use this government federally backstopped money to go and make very, very risky bets. And you'll see this in, you know, all of the inflation in any financial product that we have these days, from, you know, risky derivatives like credit default swaps all the way to, you know, speculation in oil prices, which is one of the reasons we're seeing these prices at the pump these days. And if you're going to try and counter that particular problem, this idea of, you know, too much really cheap money and too much moral hazard that these banks have, you have to go back and say, what did we do to make these things happen in the first place, and how can we get them? And if we can finally fix that problem and kind of get back on track to a system where, you know, things are reasonably regulated and these markets are functioning in a way that makes a little bit more sense, maybe at that point they can finally go and say, who were the actual criminals here? But, you know, I feel like they want to kind of try and stop the flood before they start going through and really trying to place blame at this point.
Well, in a way, though, Caitlin, if you had a perp walk with some of these big bankers, as happened back in the S&L crisis, I've talked to Bill Black, the chief prosecutor, a number of times back then. He put about 1,000 people behind bars. And a perp walk would be a kind of teachable moment, because and the trials that follow, at least the public would find out what these people were up to. One of the problems that I understand is, particularly with getting rid of Glass-Steagall, et cetera, is a lot of the extraordinary criminality and fraud was actually legal.
Sure. And this is something that we've really focused on in you know, looking at the specifics of the Volcker Rule. What was really remarkable about it was that, you know, they tended to use about 300 pages describing what you can and can't do and, you know, what the specifics should look like, but nowhere in the whole rule did they impose any real penalties. They said you can't do speculation, you can't do any risky activities, but nowhere did they say what would happen to you if you did. It seems like the kind of the strongest penalty that they had was saying, if we find you're doing what would be an illegal activity, you have to take that trade off. And that was basically it. And that is not the kind of, you know, strict penalty that's really going to encourage these people to not do these things. So, you know, one thing is making them illegal. I mean, I think one thing you would have to look back over time and say, realistically, based on what the regulatory environment was for the past decade, most of what we now see as very clearly fraudulent or criminal behavior, it wasn't necessarily explicitly illegal at the time. So it's really hard to go back and say, you know, these people were, you know, what was obviously probably not tremendously moral activity might not have been explicit violations of the law. And it's really important that they get this part right when they're trying to figure out how to fix this mess, is to figure out exactly what is wrong and exactly what people should be afraid of if they're going to try and avert this law in some way.
Well, what about the role of the press, though, in the Fourth Estate, Caitlin Klein, in informing the public? I mean, the public have a lot of anger about what happened. And after all, it was the anger about what happened on Wall Street that propelled the Tea Party into existence. And curiously enough, you know, the political left in this country, the Democrats, should have owned that issue, and they let it slip through their fingers, which I find quite mystifying. But look what's happening now with the price of gasoline. Almost every day you have stories on local TV news and in newspapers about the high price of gas. None of it is really looking into what's really behind it. And it's not as if we haven't seen this movie before. Back in the summer of 2008, gasoline oil went up to $147 a barrel. And then 60 Minutes exposed the fact that it was all to do with speculation through the Goldman Sachs index. And 80% of the, or to 90% of the contracts apparently now, future contracts for oil aren't being bought up by the end users like oil refineries and airlines, but by speculators. And there is a global glut of oil. There's much less global demand, more supply. The same applies here in the United States. So the external, anybody could find this out in 1 second. I don't get it.
No, and it's something that is a little bit kind of unique in some ways to the financial industry, is the idea that a lot of times the public feel as if they're not, you know, they're not informed enough to be making decisions on this or to be kind of accurately judging things. And you can, easily get, you know, this very powerful and vocal lobby from the financial industry saying, no, we're doing everything right. You just don't understand. It's a supply and demand problem. You guys don't get it. You know, we're doing the best that we can, and this is just what happens in the market. And this is very clearly not true. But I think that a lot of times the public isn't so confident in stepping in and saying, wait a second, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. These things don't, you know, everybody's kind of basic understanding of economics is really violated by what you're saying. But, you know, they're men in suits, and they sound pretty convincing, and this is something that people kind of take for granted. And, you know, one of the most remarkable things that we've noticed, and now it's been 2 years or more since they've been trying to get this Dodd-Frank Act passed, and kind of at the beginning of it, there was so much public outcry of against bankers and what they were doing. And somehow in this past 2 years, that really vocal, you know, animosity from the public has really subdued a lot. And you can see that by the way in which the lobbyists are coming through and making these sweeping judgments and really putting influence on the rulemaking process, because people aren't complaining anymore. And they have, you know, happily stepped back into this position of saying, no, what we do is very important to the public and to the economy, and everybody is really reliant on us doing this great job. And that, you know, yelling and screaming from the public isn't there anymore. And, you know, it's pretty frustrating, because that's an incredibly important part of this fight, is not only the banks, but also, you know, the regulators knowing that they have the public on their side if they're trying to come up with really strong, useful enforcement.
So, Caitlin Klein, again, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street composed of former financial professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of counter-lobby. Are you suggesting then, Caitlin, that what the Wall Street culture has done is create a kind of a priesthood with a with all of this sort of Byzantine theology that's really ultimately just smoke and mirrors, and is that what's going on?
I think very much. I mean, I think that, you know, you have people like Ben Bernanke sitting in these very smart, very accomplished people who can basically say whatever they want, right? And they can get these ideas across because nobody really wants to stand up and say, I know better than this man. And unfortunately, most of the elite in, you know, certainly the economics and financial economics professions, they're all kind of on the same team in that capacity. And outside voices and critical voices aren't usually heard, certainly aren't heard loudly enough. And, you know, it's a pretty unfortunate part. You know, it would be the same thing as if, you know, physicists had a seat at the policy table. It would be difficult for, you know, regular mom-and-pop kind of people to come in and say, you know, I don't think what you're saying is true. Right. And so they kind of get this free pass without oversight that makes it very, very difficult for people to, you know, kind of call them on things that don't necessarily make sense. You know, when they say, but why is my gas prices so high? This affects me on a day-to-day basis. You know, this man seems to think that it all makes sense, and I kind of just have to take that. And it's pretty unfortunate.
Well, I guess in a way, Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Fed, was the greatest practitioner of mumbo-jumbo and smoke and mirrors.
Absolutely. And you know, this has been something, I don't think it's an accident that this is the way it is, right? Mm. You know, they very much even academically, the economics profession is, you know, there is a very clear agenda, and this is taught from day one, and it's kind of a machine that gets these people, you know, even, you know, the very basic kind of free market economics that's taken as gospel. You know, there's a lot of contrary voices out there that say, you know, maybe a lot of this doesn't make sense, but you just don't hear about that. It's just not institutionalized in that mm-hmm. way.
So, Caitlin Klein, you're a former credit derivatives trader. I recall Warren Buffett referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. And I talked to an entrepreneur the other day who had a lot of experience in the finance world and has done very well for himself. He was saying that that's the big ticking bomb out there, what, 700 trillion or something, unbelievable number. Tell us about what's out there as this kind of financial iceberg looming while we rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic.
So there's just this whole industry that is based around creating products that can, you know, potentially provide value at some point to some person. And that some person isn't always the economy at whole. In fact, you know, in recent years, it's often not. It's often a few people who kind of have a stake in creating, you know, extremely complex, you know, things that have price exposures all over the place. And, you know, if you were to ask a credit derivatives trader on the street what they do, they would say, oh, we dissipate risk. You know, this is a thing that we trade that helps people offset their risk and take the specific pieces that they want and spread the rest out, and it helps the economy and it keeps things, you know, working smoothly. And you kind of can look right now, particularly as Greece is approaching default, and this whole market that has shown up around credit derivatives that was supposed to dissipate the risk that would happen in a default is a complete mess, and people are on the line for a lot of money because these products don't have any inherent social value. And it's very difficult to look in the times of trouble and say, you know, people are going to lose a lot of money because they created this sort of pseudo market. And this happens in all products. There's derivatives on basically anything. You can get a weather derivative, you know, and they basically cover almost any aspect of human life, and people have money waged on these things. And it's a kind of a very scary time, because it used to be something that you could look at financial markets and say, okay, I kind of get a stock and I get a bond. These are things that I understand, and I can monitor them on a day-to-day basis, and it can kind of all these pieces of this puzzle can come together. It's much harder to do that now as you get more and more risky securities. And the world of finance is so unbelievably intertwined, and there's so much risk from so many different places all interconnecting itself. This is one of the biggest challenges they have for too big to fail, because you have these massively huge organizations that are all very, very much in bed with each other, and the decline of one could mean the decline of all of them, and that's a very, very scary thing for, you know, the future of regular people.
Well, we've recently had the scandal involving Corzine, a former head of Goldman Sachs, and then went on to become a U.S. senator, and then went back to Wall Street and managed to tank this organization and a whole bunch of money. I think $1.6 billion or so disappeared. And apparently the money can't be found. I mean, talk about financial alchemy. They just make stuff disappear and nobody can pin it on anybody.
And this is a pretty funny one, because you kind of have to sit back and say somebody somewhere knows where this money is. But there is no real attempt, you know, there's no real global outrage for people to say, no, just find it. Money doesn't disappear these days. It should be quite possible to go and track a series of money transfers and figure out where this is all sitting. And it's that kind of remarkable ability to sort of put a sheet over it and say, oh, no, this is just a thing that we can't quite figure out right now. Oh, well, avert your eyes. There's other news going on. And these kinds of, you know, $1.6 billion is more than a slight blip. Something very serious happened organizationally in this process, and there was a huge failure on a lot of ends, and it's important for us to know what that was. I mean, you have to keep in mind that MF Global was a primary dealer, and they were able to borrow from the Fed, and this is something that affects everybody, because taxpayer dollars are actually at stake here. But, you know, this idea that it was kind of this isolated incident, it wasn't a big bank, it didn't require a bailout per se, so we don't really care, is pretty troubling.
Now, in terms of the cop on the beat, Mary Shapiro, her predecessor, Donaldson, apparently was a fairly decent guy under Bush, trying to do the right thing. Bush fired him, I assume, with pressure from Wall Street, because the guy was actually trying to do his job. Then they put in this disgraceful guy called Christopher Cox, who was just not only an ideologue, but was stupid. That's when the whole crash happened. Obama had a chance to put a good cop on the beat, and my understanding is that Mary Shapiro is not that person.
Yeah, you know, I think in kind of the greater sense of who could have ended up in that position, particularly coming off people like Christopher Cox, you know, I think we could have done a lot worse. I think we've been really discouraged for, you know, certainly some remarks she's made lately, you know, particularly with respect to the Volcker Rule, saying things along the lines of, no, we're not going to go and persecute anyone for any little trade that doesn't follow it. You know, we're just going to kind of try and wait for big violations and that stuff. Don't worry, we're not looking too closely. Business as usual. I mean, this is really, you know, the opposite of what, like you said, the cop on the beat should be saying. You know, they should be saying, we're going to be after you for everything that you do, and we're going to be watching, and it's important that all banks and everyone that we regulate follows the rules. And that's the opposite of the rhetoric she's given, and it's really frustrating, particularly as a member of the public, believing that there needs to be someone on your side here. And it would be really nice to know that you had somebody there who really had the right priorities in mind, you know, someone like, you know, Brooksley Bourne, for instance, at the CFTC. Like, these are things that would have been really nice for us to have someone on our side, and it really doesn't feel that way. Not really in many of the agencies do we feel like, you know, the priorities are in order.
Well, just in closing, Caitlin Klein, tell us about how your group, Occupy SEC, has been working within the Occupy Wall Street movement, because we've spoken a lot with Occupy Wall Street. Not that there's anybody, you know, in charge of it, but I'd like to get an understanding of how you're working together.
So Occupy the SEC is a working group within the Occupy Wall Street movement. We are an autonomous group. We don't speak for Occupy, obviously. But we are all individuals who kind of came together in the New York City General Assembly area, because we were all people who used to work in finance or were somehow related to it or had a, you know, a keen interest in it, and saw that, you know, right now there's this big opportunity for us to really use what we know and try and have a voice about these rules that are being put in place to potentially stop future financial crisis from happening. So we kind of got together and started to have effectively a book club, where our book was this proposed Volcker rule. And the idea was to kind of go through it and read it line by line and figure out what needs to be said to counter what the lobbyists will be trying to say when they go through and submit their letters. Because typically in this process, the only people who ever really comment are the banks and their lobbyists. The public really turns away after the rule itself has been written. So we wanted to shine a light on this part of the process. It's incredibly important. And, you know, together through our expertise and other contacts that we made within the Occupy Wall Street movement, there's a lot of really brilliant minds out there who want to make a change. And we're hoping to use it as a venue to really promote, you know, this idea that there are other people out there who care and know enough about this to really try and make sure that the rulemaking process works for people and not just for banks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Caitlin Klein.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Caitlin Klein, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street, composed of former finance professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of anti-lobby. Occupy SEC recently submitted a 325-page comment letter to the SEC and other regulators on the so-called Volcker Rule, arguing for strong regulations and oversight of federally backstopped banks and the prohibition of risky activities within them.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nicholas Walrath. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.